Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 9th of August 2020. Hope you're all doing, I can't see okay, well, as best as you can through all the nonsense we're going through and the planned chaos. Everything's tying into everything else for those who haven't quite figured it out yet. It's not separate things that are happening on a big scale just by chance. And not when you have the richest people on the planet and all the corporations that run our lives financing what seems to be the, which not, what doesn't even seem to be, they announce it to be a communist revolution inside America and across the world. It's no mystery at all as to who funds them. They published it, of course, and I mentioned that last week and the week before as well. The big corporations there, so you really have to just scratch your head. This is a Bolshevik revolution, for those who don't know what really is going on. And the Bolsheviks really used all the other existing social organizations for socialism. There were different shades of them back then in the old days in Russia. And they use them all. The Bolsheviks always use the majority, and they agitate to make sure the majority do all their fighting for them, and then they jump in and take it over towards the end. That's the strategy of it. It's well documented before about the funding for the old Bolshevik revolution, and he had Trotsky caught at Nova Scotia on his way over to Germany, then to Russia, with suitcases full of cash, literally American dollars, and he was caught by customs and at Nova Scotia Harbour, and they put him in the clanger for a little while, in prison, in jail, awaiting information from the States as to what they're going to do with this guy with all his cash, etc., heading off. This is in wartime, and don't forget that Russia at that time was actually fighting against Germany. These are all important little facts, and so the Bolsheviks, of course, had help from Western allies as well. We know this, but we had it too from the big top bankers in America. Baruch and these guys helped to fund the Bolshevik revolution. But anyway, it came eventually, and it's well documented, and it's in the archives of Canada. What happened there with Trotsky, and apparently a passport, an American passport, was rushed up to Canada by train, and for Trotsky and it was literally advocated that he be let go by President Wilson of the U.S. at the time. So he went off in his merry way, and of course we know what happened. It wasn't just to do with the money; they're preparing it. They've been preparing it for years. This whole revolution, and who was going to take it over, etc. Geopolitics. So, as I say, there you go through the same kind of thing here. Now, instead of just having the bankers, you have that too. A big, you see the bankers who put money towards the communist groups, the ones who've openly said that they're Marxist agitators for revolution. Now, you don't have Marxist revolutionaries that want a little bit of Marxism, for those who think, well, they don't want to go all the way. No, it's a doctrine that does go all the way. That's the whole point of it, is to completely overthrow the current system and put themselves in charge, and then to eradicate stacks of people, maybe into the millions, in order for themselves to survive, because they know that the public won't be happy, especially those who can communicate and who know what's going on. So they must be eliminated altogether, because they might contaminate the population with their ideas of, do you know that you're getting used and you're being conned? You know, that's just, you can't have that going on. So you got to get rid of these people. And that's what they do. So what you're seeing in the States right now is the biggest example of it, really. It's happening across the world in different stages, but and it's also advocated by the United Nations departments as well. So, you know, there's no mystery to me about this. I've talked about communism running the United Nations for years and years and years. And communism is run by an elite of the world. And the same elite runs both sides of everything pretty well. This is a dialectical technique that they use. And you got to remember, too, UNESCO was set up by Julian Huxley, a member of the British aristocracy, and a descendant too, who's also related to Darwin. They're all related to Darwin and eugenics, etc. So at the top of the tree you have disorganization, setting up all different factions for different sides and funding them, of course, to the hilt. Because as I say, if you and they want to, they'll rule the world. That's the whole point, is ruling the world and being gods, you know, taking their place as the gods running the earth. And I think Bill Gates is a good example. I don't think I know of anybody that prays to him. Not yet, anyway. And this is the farce they give you, characters like that. But these are front people too. The ones at the top I've said before, you generally never see or even get a whiff of, because they're the real bosses. They're not workers. Again, I've mentioned it before, how they're all society was set up and why it was set up. And it was an occultic organization initially. You had to be a member and a Freemason to join eventually. But when they set it up, the first so-called, it was an experiment to put in their garden behind their building. It was a glass beehive to really symbolize the perfect management of the perfect world, with this ordered society from the top right down to the bottom, the drones. And again, so eugenics, a smattering of eugenics there too. And also to guide society. People don't realize it was meant to guide society by bringing in members of different, and even creating members of different sciences and orders, and publicizing, again, making them, and today we call them making them superstars, like it was mentioned before. In the investigations into the Unabomber too, some of the people that he was after, some of his targets, were professors in universities that also ran, and one of them mentioned it too, that he ran an organization, like a public relations campaign organization, that created stars for scientists. So they made scientists into stars, knowing that people would follow them. And so not everything out there is really fake. I mean, there's very little out there that really is exactly what it says it is. It doesn't mean that all the information that these organizations they put out are completely untrue. But if you're being deceived at all, then you can take the whole lot with a pinch of salt, obviously. How much deception do you want to swallow? But again, so they make scientists into stars. They did it with Einstein. That was a nobody, really, until he was picked up and to be the voice of modern society for the 20th century. And he was put forward as a front man, really, to advocate CERN. And most of his talks were about world government and even world Zionism and its place in all politics. He seldom ever gave a talk on science. And when he did, it was from other scientists' papers that he read all the time. But nevertheless, he's still pushed today as some genius. But that's what they give you. So back to their own society, that was their goal, you see. So even in the early days, they would promote the well-known names you know today that helped to guide the world in evolution and evolution of humanity, leading to eugenics, you see, and the purpose of eugenics. Very important that. And we know too, that they brought in other members that ran the Royal Mint in Britain. Very important to get the Royal Mint in there, because it's a science. Counting money in a magical formula is definitely a science. And it's very secretive, because, and it must take years to study, because you and I could be given the same kind of figures and debt, you know, and what money is coming in, things, and we could work it out, and we'd never get the same numbers as these specialists get. It's impossible. So yeah, they're geniuses now, obviously, because we can't figure out. So they brought everybody on board too, and I think Newton was a member of them too. Everybody who's anybody's a member, even brought Marx in at one point too. Karl Marx. Why would they bring Karl Marx in? Well, you see, social domination requires social studies, and social studies, if you want to alter society, need doctrines. So you bring in these doctrines that advocate change, and you guide the change into what you want it to be. And I used to be puzzled about that too. Why would Britain, during the 19th century, really amazing agitations were going on at the time. And Britain was very important in causing a lot of these dissatisfactions across the world, because they sent agitators, they were trained specialists in agitation, into different countries to take them down. And a lot of the Catholic countries too, they want you to take down. They've been doing that since, of course, the days of Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh, who, as they plundered the Spanish galleons. So they really had it in for, of course, any Catholic countries, because they couldn't get a firm grip on their banking system. They couldn't steal it, in other words. So you got to get rid of the religion to make that happen. So you had that Newton and a whole bunch of different people on board with them to shape society and guide society by putting out the versions of science which would influence our behavior and our beliefs, you see. And that hasn't changed to this day. It's interesting too, when you could, a lot of their members, in fact, not just Charles Darwin, and Darwin himself, of course, they actually backed Darwin on his voyage across parts of the world to do with evolution. And so they backed him, and it's been admitted to since by them that they tried to stifle the reports that were coming in from another guy who did the real work that Darwin was stealing. And it was a guy called Wallace, I think he was a Scotsman too. And he was living the life in these countries and doing all the writing and sending it back to Charles, not to publish under Charles' name, but just to have as references and so on. And Darwin published it. There was a big scandal eventually, but it was hushed up by those in the know, in the Royal Society. Because, you see, you had to go through along this route to evolution, that man's really descended from apes, etc. And if you convince the public of that, then they could then convince you that would explain and validate the necessity of having the class system, the superior types, middle and then inferior types, or the workers, very much along the lines of Brave New World, where they would perfect that system by breeding the different strata of workers. Again, very Marxist too, where you had the distribution of labour. You know, they would work out who would do what kind of tasks, you see. And then everyone according to his means or his needs. Then they would reward those at the top much better in a communist system, naturally, because it's a class system. And it believes that science rules, so the brighter folk should rule the rest. And there should be no such thing as debating that. Just get on with it, do what you're told, and obey the experts and scientists. That's really what Marxism brought you in the Soviet system. Therefore, science is always used by the far left, and right too, of course, when they're playing the game, to manage the public, to make the public believe that experts should be obeyed, basically, no dispute, and under the guise that they present you with true facts, you see. And there's nothing, as we can see today, further from the truth than most things at all. Everything is utterly politicized, and corruption is rampant through the scientific communities, as it is with pretty well everything else in this day and age. But yet, getting back to the idea of communism, I used to wonder, why on earth would Britain, a country that had sent stacks of different infiltrators across Europe into Holland and places to overthrow governments there and religions as well, in order to rule in these different countries, you know. And this is under really the city of London. The average person in England probably wouldn't have a clue either what was going on any more than they did in Scotland or anywhere else. But the city of London is where they had this high education to train agitators and true spies, etc. Those who deal with what they call the black arts of manipulation and assassinations and coercions and so on, overthrowing nations. And Britain definitely, or London was definitely the capital for a long, long time, still is to an extent too. It doesn't matter about the economy being shattered across the rest of the country long before COVID came along. But the city of London is really a nation unto itself in so many different ways. But London, remember, put up Karl Marx. Why would you put up an agitator who was really, he ran out of Germany, a lot of them run out of Germany and start up in Britain. And so why would a monarchy in a monarchical government or democracy, as you call it, Britain, with all its you just don't argue with that kind of government. You see, they're very good at what they do in Britain. They're very calm, and they might give you a rope for a while, but they'll come for after you eventually and get you, and you won't even see it coming. They're no rush, you see, and they do things very efficiently when it comes to removing problems of all kinds. Well, they brought in Karl Marx, and knowing exactly what he was, who was putting a doctrine to overthrow all established governments, including the monarchy, etc. But Britain puts them up and allows them to stay there. And true enough, you know, they didn't really have a terrible revolution in Britain because of Karl Marx in that kind of fashion at the time. They had won the Docklands, I think it was, down near the Docklands, and were under the Thames at one point near the 20th century. But that was quickly, so that was just about a few dozen of them tried that to hold themselves up in some of the buildings there, and they were quickly outed by just police, in fact, with shotguns, I think. But regardless, they didn't have a massive revolutionary movement going on inside Britain itself, and not openly. They gave you a tamer version. And there's no such thing, as I've said before, of tamer Marxism. Yeah, it's either complete or not at all. But they gave you a Fabian style, a slow takeover. Now, for those who think that again, this incredible establishment inside the city of London, where the whole, I mean, an empire was run from there. They had intelligence agencies running all of these countries across the world, and all of their economic systems and trade, commerce and banking and all the rest of it, military, all nothing was missed back then. Nothing at all was missed, even before the age of computers. So for anyone who thinks that Britain just didn't notice Karl Marx, who literally was given the right to give speeches in some of the biggest theatres in London, yeah. I don't think they just didn't quite hear him properly when he talked about overthrowing established governments. He heard him perfectly fine. But you can use a guy like that, you see, because down the road, you can use Marxism. See, the elite don't think as you do. They're not trained to be naive their whole lives long from birth to death. You are. But the elite who run the world, and then there are certain bases that they've lived in for a while, they're nomadic to an extent, but they settle for a century here, a couple of centuries there, and so on. And yet they also have homes across the planet, but they know that they can use all types of sides, the creation of sides, to their own advantage down the road. It might suit them to have a fast bout of communism for a little while, bringing in austerity and eradicating a lot of bright people. Because communism does that, you see, it eradicates the brighter folk often. And this, I'm not talking about just education. If you're bright at all, if you have a bit of insight, then, again, as I've said before, the Soviets called it inflexibility of opinion. If they couldn't persuade you to just join them, you know, see it our way, this is for the greater good, etc. You know, poverty is for the greater good and for a brighter tomorrow, for the great-grandchildren. If you didn't go along with it, then they classified you as insane. Because number one, you complained about their wonderful communist utopia. So you had to be insane, because it was so beautiful. I mean, there's nothing better ever invented than communist utopia. And workers' paradises and things like that. And so you were just there's no trial. You were put straight into a loony bin and kept drugged until you died, generally, with inhalation, pneumonia or something, because you start drooling and then you breathe in. And that happens still today with different drugs like Haldol. they tend to bump into people, and especially in old folks' homes now. Has been happening for years. But the communist system could be used down the road, you see, to destabilize other nations and to get the change. Remember, change takes at least two sides. If you've got a happy society, or fairly content, there's no such thing as perfection anywhere with humanity. Look at your own moods. And look at many things have changed your minds down through your lifetime. But regardless, as you say, you can use different sites to make the change happen. If you had a fairly okay system, and yeah, there's a lot of injustice and blah, 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 as you always will get with humans, and you don't really want to change it, but the elite do want to change it for their own particular reasons, which they won't tell you about, then they'll advocate again the antithesis. You're the thesis, the system as it is. The antithesis is a group that, well, we're dissatisfied or whatever. And then you have your agitation and your arguments threatening war even amongst the two groups. And then you come to an agreement, different agreements and concessions. And a concession means you start walking backwards to an extent to keep the peace. And then you have your synthesis, that's your end product, which you desired all along. So you need the two sides. You need two sides to create change. At least two sides. Sometimes you get three, like sheepdogs. It's often described as using sheepdogs. And and it's wonderful to watch trained sheepdogs, collie dogs, in Wales, for instance. And you'll still see, I don't know if they still have the big sheepdog competitions every year, where you would see them. And they did in Yorkshire, I think, too. You would see these collies, these border collies, they call them the dark and white, and black and white dogs. Working so wonderfully together, and the shepherds just whistling to them, certain whistles, a language to the dogs, and they could literally take these sheep from these mountains, round them up, guide them down the hills in a certain direction, go left, right, the whole bit, and eventually bring them into a pen, and then guide them all into the pen without any human help at all, except the whistling that was going on to the dogs. Wonderful to watch it. But when you watch the dogs working, that's how we're guided too. You're with the sheep, right? You're having a good chew in the grass there. It's a nice warm day, and not too warm because you got all that wool on you, and it's a little breeze, put it that way. And you're quite content, and it's good grass, and maybe a bit of clover flower there too. Eh? So you're chomping away, and it's quite good. And all your pals around you, yeah, they're all chomping away, and you're all smiling and all that. And then what do you see? You see a dog coming from your left, and you're watching that dog because it's sneaking along. It almost crawls along the ground. And you get a bit restless here. So the dog's moving towards you, you see, from the left. So you move to start moving to the right, all of you, you know. Somebody up ahead said, you see, let's go. And so you all follow the person that says, the sheep that says, let's go. And away you go, you see. But as you're going on there, and you can't see all that far in front of you because of the other sheep, but there's another dog coming from the right, eh? And so you say, what do we do now, eh? What do we do now? And you're starting to go back to the left, but there's that other dog. So you're sandwiched in between them. It's okay, we can go forward or back, you see, and rather than go right or left. But would you know, as you start to move just to the north a bit, another sheepdog's there. And so you're starting to panic now, eh? Left, right, and from the north, so there's only one place left, and you start bolting down south, you see. And along come these three dogs with you, eh? And you look around, and there they are, you know. So you know not to go to the right or the left or try to go back up because the dogs are there. And they can guide you step by step right into that pen, even if it's a mile or two away at times. Amazing you watch it. And that's exactly how we're managed, the same thing. People sheep take the path of least resistance. That's where they get into trouble, you know. And we are the same. Most people, all the studies have done, countless studies, on us. We're the most studied species on the planet. It's not the baboon or the monkey, or it's not some rat or a mouse living in some strange country, and it's not some strange little insect that excretes through their orifices some kind of strange gum on a tree that you can use to make a type of a lacquer. But this is how it's done. The path of least resistance. And we take it. That's what humans do all the time. We don't like stress. We're just like the sheep. It's a natural thing not to like stress. And at one time, you see, you would accept stress in more natural times when you had some, you had some wisdom. Wisdom is a very important word, because wisdom, at one time you were born with it, you see, wisdom. And yeah, and you still need your, the parents. I've mentioned it before. The mammals, the parents of mammals, and so on, have to guide a newborn for quite a while into what to be afraid of or to what to be cautious about, because they want to. Even young bears, they'll walk right up to you, quite happy, they want to play with you. But unfortunately, big mama's behind somewhere, and she's got different ideas. But yeah, young mammals can be very friendly. They have no idea that you could be a bad dude, you see. So that's how they'd be taught that by their parents for survival. And so you have that basic instinct for survival and preservation of yourself and your species, basically. If you really have none at all, if you're completely domesticated, you've lost that ability to think quick for your own survival. And that's why we breed domesticated animals. I'm not talking about dogs and cats, I'm talking about animals for feeding. So you're domesticated, or you domesticate horses, like Hercules and Animal Farm, the horse. And you'll pull that plow all day long and get really nothing out of it, really, you know, but except the oatmeal and water pretty well, and a rub down. But he's domesticated. Otherwise, he would try and get out and run off. And occasionally, you'll see that where an animal, they call it a throwback to a more natural time where it had more instincts, will leave a domesticated group or a herd. The clever ones, they don't just attack the person who's rearing them to eat. They'll actually run off. They're clever. They'll say, there's no point in attacking that guy. They'll come after me. So you simply wait, bide your time and watch what happens and try to get out of the corral. Right? And that's what they do. There's one in Australia a few years ago, and it became famous, this one. I think it was a Marana type sheep, a particular type of wool, and a lot of wool too. But he vamoosed from the herd, and he was found a few years later. He found a cave somewhere. And he was living in a cave. I guess he came out later in the day and folk didn't see him or whatever, but he's far away from civilization. And he had a happy life. They'd hate him at the United Nations. They teach you that loners are dangerous people or dangerous animals. Eh? In other words, if you're a person who quite likes privacy, like in Canada, I mentioned that one of 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, where some old fella had gone in to get groceries, and I guess there's a dispute. They're pretty nasty, some of these women, actually. And these stores, they're so freaked out, they just turn on anybody who doesn't comply. And I guess the old guy didn't know to wear a mask or whatever, because they keep changing their minds on what you're supposed to do. And he had a little dispute, went home, the cops followed him home, then they shot him. Dead, you know. So this is where it's come to, you see. And they even said in the paper, the man was a loner. Like, that was the crime, eh? He was a loner. He lived in a house that he built, that he paid for, and it was a good price he paid for it, too. And he didn't encourage the visitors. He liked his privacy. But that's a crime now, you see. But that validates your death right there. And don't forget, in the United Nations, they've said over and over, that even again, they've recycled the same story, that the greatest threat to the agenda for world peace is individualism. Meaning, again, the person who thinks for themselves might like a bit of privacy, and you might be a bit of a loner. It's a crime to be a loner. Obviously, something wrong with you, right? Yeah, obviously. And not like all the characters that hung around Jeffrey, all the gregarious social types who like to go to parties and have it off with little children. And get blackmailed for it. That type, you know, the gregarious type, anything but, no, they're okay, they're just falling for their basic instincts, you see. But anyone who avoids all that stuff in the partying lifestyle, they go, oh, hey, come on, hey, there you go. So it's dangerous now to know things. It's dangerous to be a loner as well, obviously. It can be deadly. and it's taboo by the United Nations, the wonderful communist United Nations, set up again, by the same characters that put up Karl Marx in London. The guys who ran the British Empire, Lord Alfred Milner at that time. And out of them came they eventually morphed into the legitimate title that folk got to know, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, private club, mind you. A big club, but private. And they ran the British Empire. But there's the guys that put up Karl Marx. And they had sponsorship, too. And they eventually gave you the League of Nations, and then they morphed into the United Nations. So, again, here's the richest characters on the planet. Lord Alfred Milner, who really was a German, or born in Germany. And a lot of guys with him actually were actually not really born or British as such. A big story to it. But they worked as a very tight team to run the British Empire and to conquer other nations, as long as they themselves took over the resources of the country, including diamonds and gold and baubles like that, you see. And that was okay. That was okay, because they ran the empire, so they could make these rules, you see, for themselves. And royalty never complained about it, because they got good kickback for advocating that the military should back up their ventures for them, and the taxpayer would pay for all. Which is a great setup, really. And of course, that's where the idea of fascism really came from, where governments worked with corporations and they worked with like a brotherhood, you might say, like a liaison, like something tighter than a family, the corporations and the banks, the mercantile banks, the merchant bankers, and government worked together to make sure it kept, you know, the trade would flow and their trade would flow and the public would pay for the upkeep of it all, for armies and navies and things like that. It was a good deal for those who owned the corporations. Nothing much has changed in a sense, is it? Really? But again, back to what I'm trying to say here is this organization didn't nip communism in dead, in its tracks, and folk are so astonished as to why they let it happen in the Soviet system, in Russia, I should say. The whole thing is, if you have a long-term enterprise, and this is how intelligence agencies work as well, the really big high ones, there's different levels of immediate action and long-term planning, and long-term planning is just big business plans, as I've said before. Business plans and corporations, they have their projections into 50 to some of them 100 years in the future. Well, that's exactly how the big intelligence agencies work as well. Where will they be in 100 years? And so they have 10-year plans and even 5-year plans. You see the exact same terminology used for the United Nations as you saw in the Soviet system. Well, this part of the plan will take 5 years, a 5-year plan to get the workers up to a better income or more bread or whatever, will take 10 years. That's a 10-year plan. And to put pipelines in, and they'll take 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. That's how it's done. It was all modelled really from London, the city of London, for a while. Again, folk are so ignorant of it, they really don't have a clue that the US and Britain financed in the 1920s and 30s the building of the infrastructure for power, for industry, for the Soviet system. And we sent over lots and lots of engineers, and they even built up, I think that they used to have an awfully good documentary was put out by Russia itself, in fact. And they set up streets, like villages for these scientists in the Soviet system. And they built them, and even made the houses look like middle-class suburbia America, to make them feel at home with all the comforts of home and things. They even brought in cars from the States and things like that. And had them really help rebuild everything for Russia, for the electrical supplies and implementation of power lines and all that kind of stuff, into factories and so on. A tremendous cooperation for a system, let's get back to the basics, which swore on oath to overthrow every other system, including the ones that were helping them. Try to figure that one out. And it's until you stand back and say, okay, the Lord Alfred Milner group that planned long-term, even during the taking over of Africa and South Africa and places like that, and when they were working at it, they were already working on 100 years down the road where they would merge all this into a global system with a kind of embryo of a global government with global standardized rules, massive bureaucracy, running commerce and rules and trade rules and all the rest of it, and free trade. That's where all that came from, was their group, free trade. And so you have them working short time to get plans implemented, as they were taking over resources in South Africa. And then with the Jameson raid, they actually had a bunch of mercenaries belonging to the Lord Alfred Milner group who went in and started slaughtering Dutch settlers and to get retaliation against. And sure enough, and this group were not part of the slaughtering, were not part of the English settlement. They came into the country for the revolution. The Milner group also had a woman reporter in, they brought in from London, it was the London Times, who was in on the act, and she had prepared in advance the stories that the Boers had attacked the English or British settlements. And that would really, then they would say in Britain, oh, outrage, outrage, this is terrible, look what they've done to our settlements. And then, of course, they'd advocate that the British military go in, and the taxpayer would fund all of that, and they would take over the country. That's exactly what happened, you see. A long, long stories with all of this. But anyway, once they did that, of course, they eventually appointed their own members in as the governor generals of these countries, these areas in these countries. So you would have a different idea of where they were going to go, judging from the little information that you're giving out to the public as to their intentions. But you'd be stuck in a little bubble. I always call them bubbles, because they are bubbles. That's a good way to imagine them. And of what it's all about in your particular era. You wouldn't see the bigger plan. You wouldn't see that down the road they planned to eventually take more and more countries into this an African Union. And they would even use communism to galvanize other countries to join the African Union, you see. That planned long, long, long ago. And that's how things are really done in the real intelligence agencies. Sometimes you get the grandchildren working on the plan in the same intelligence agencies, their own grandchildren. And so they know it very well what their part in the plan is and their vector or sector in the world. And they might have a few members or siblings too working on it as well, generation after generation. So they know exactly what they're doing. And it's really a super civil service that runs it all, you see. So anyway, and their outer party and their inner party, just like George Orwell had in 1984. But the true Lord Alfred Milner group had the inner group, you see, and their circle of friends and outside and all that. So and of course, if there's a CFR branch for America, every country's got a branch of them, and including the Far East as well. So there's nothing happening today that wasn't planned at least 100 years ago, and probably more longer. And you could never figure it out in your particular little short lifetime, during your span, from what you're taught, which is very superficial, that things are happening are obviously from an outside source to make these, because you're overthrowing something that you've understood as to be, you know, normal for quite a long time. It's getting overthrown now. It would never figure, it never dawn on you that it's done by the same group, because now it's time to use another side, another group, to cause the conflict to get the changes they desire to the next phase. That's how it's done. And this is this kind of thing that Rockefeller used to talk about too, old man Rockefeller, and David Rockefeller too, that they could take over the resources of the world. Rockefeller said, old man Rockefeller said, and so did David, that competition was a sin. And he's talking on very esoteric terms too. And I won't go into the particular religion and all that, but he was going into that idea of it, that competition was a sin. And therefore standardization, that's why his companies were called Standard Oil, standardization of all resources with under the auspices of guys like himself, like a club, was the right thing to do. And they would keep prices high, and then they could create the stock market, and then through investments they could keep the stocks way up and all the different shares and things, keep tight control of everything. That's the idea. Monopoly men. And they all come again from this particular group going way back. And we know of them in Lord Alfred Milner's time, simply because a lot of the deeds were published and written about, even some of them by Milner himself. But again, later on too, they have their own archives, their own history archives. They're so important to the manipulation of world events right up to the present that Carl Quigley said it was time that the public knew of their contribution to the changing and manipulation of history. He thought it was wonderful what they, because he was an elitist himself. But he thought it was wonderful the goals that they wanted to bring into society. And he knew the goals would be understood by the people who even fought for them. You know, think of many different regiments in Britain, for instance, as an example, and other countries too, had fought on behalf of what they thought was the right. When you're born into the system, it seems to be the right, isn't it? It's there, it exists. So it's the right. But each generation is much easier if it's a long span of change. You won't notice it so much, like a drastic change. And so you may go into the same regiments as your grandparents went into, and you still think you're fighting and maintaining the same sort of order and for civilization, etc., etc. But you never, and then when it starts to crumble, you may go to pieces yourself. Say, what on earth was it all for? And how could it suddenly collapse? You know, it wouldn't suddenly collapse. It's time to go into the next phase. And you and your and the generations of you before and your own families are just irrelevant. You're like Rockefeller said. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. You're all irrelevant to the ones at the very, very top. Well, you really are. But the public never know it. But the masters of intelligence for a long time were based in London, the city of London. Now, of course, you have they're amalgamated to an extent, as I've said before. You can't keep secrets in this day and age for long from other intelligence agencies. And apart from that, it's so wonderful today if you want to get people to infiltrate that don't even belong to your nations. Then you simply say, "Well, it's discrimination if you don't let them come in." So naturally, you can't keep secrets. Or the best you can do is to bring them in on board to the big secrets, and knowing that they're going to share it with other agencies or even an outside country that they're going to be born in. That's very common now to do today as well. And so what you do is you amalgamate the whole lot of them on a higher level. And often the ones, I would say up until the 80s maybe, the intelligence agencies, you had lots of people in it at the time that were so compartmentalized that the bulk of them didn't know there was a different agenda above them. They still believed in their little part in it, in fighting the Cold War, as it was called. And they truly believed in it because they didn't know anything else. They had no idea that eventually their own countries would advocate the same global system, eh? Well, after all, it's always been our wish to have a global government type system for the world, says the descendants of the leaders that gave you the empire. But and they don't care if they're using a communistic technique to bring it into being, because it's much easier if you create enough hardship amongst populations to get them to work for a cause. So you give them the cause. You can call it communism or socialism or whatever you want to call it, and make them think they're going to get something. Then you use them again to further the next stage of the agenda. That's a global socialism. But we'll still run the show at the top, you know. And you'll all live in a kind of austerity. It'd be very equal, because you'll all be equally poor, you see. equally poor. But nevertheless, the ones at the top will be incredibly rich, is it? Because they're the masters that manage money, and they manage international corporation. And you do want your cell phones and things, don't you? Even if you're a radical Marxist, you really want your cell phone and you want your computers and all your games and your pornography and all that kind of thing. Sure you do. So you don't mind us running it all for you, right? But at the bottom, you can all share in austerity. You can all be very austere. Well, if you help the revolution to happen for a little while, you'll get extra points and extra goodies, you see. But eventually they'll eliminate you. They always do. The truly radical types are chosen and radicalized because they're personality types. They're on the fringes. They wouldn't fit into any society for long. If you look at the old photographs of Lenin, for instance, you'll see that Lenin... You see all the original revolutionaries, the Bolsheviks, and group photographs and separate photographs, but still bunches of them and so on. And then over time, up to the Stalin's time, you see them actually airbrushing them out, different ones, just airbrushing them out. They didn't exist. That was the memory hole. As they eliminated the ones who had been used and were given all these positions of power in the NKVD, in the Cheka, and so on, before came the later KGB. And the ones who were given those positions in the early days were mass murderers. They could never fit into any society for long. So for temporarily, for the reign of terror, because they always have a reign of terror on the public to get you to submit, they put these people in charge. But then once they have the whole system getting implemented, then they have to eradicate them, because these radicals that they put in charge are too dangerous to like to slaughter, like to kill, you know. And nothing will make them happy or content, because they were misfits to begin with in any society. But initially, if you want revolution, these are the ones you pick. They're selected. Often they don't even know they've been selected for it. They think they've just fallen into the right groups and similar minds. They don't even know they've been selected to be radicalized, some of them. They don't know. There's an awful good movie, a series actually, it's a British series. They can give you an insight into really deep intelligence systems and the techniques which they use to rule. And regardless of what you think of Britain, I mean, I got out of Britain, I saw it collapsing long ago. The city of London still goes on, it's still a banking capital of the planet for investments for across the world, is the city of London, eh? And you can't beat their intelligence systems again. With intergenerational intelligence operatives that go back through, you know, maybe a couple of hundred years or more, descended from them. Tremendous educational systems to train them. They're very secretive, but they exist of archives, you know, they've archived their own secret universities with archives of incredible teachings to train them. And there are different levels of them too. You have the ones from what they call the better class families, very class conscious. And you have the ones going down into lower strata, right down to the red brick university types. So you have the granite and Ivy League, and then down to red brick type for the common folk, the working people. And then you have other ones too that train them in a kind of collegiate type, for real street work, to infiltrate little groups. They were the lower level ones, but they're all totally sworn and well trained for what they do. So I mentioned before about a movie, it was called The Last Enemy from Britain, a good one or two or three part series, with a good story to it, which showed you, even back in 2009 or 10, whenever it was made, how GCHQ could operate with thousands of people, and know everything that was going on, every keystroke on every computer was all monitored, and instant retrieval. And so it showed a lot of the workings there, including creating a virus to give to people in different countries, knowing they would eventually try to get into Britain illegally, and they could trace them that way, because they could t- test positive for the particular virus. You can even tell what area they came from, you know. So you have stories within stories, but in the process of it, they show you a lot of technology and utter confidence that they have of the fact that there's nothing about any of you out there that they don't know. Even if you put masks on and put black outfits on and go rioting, they still know who you are. And they'll use you. But another one, too, is awfully good, and you've heard of the one that was put out by Mel Gibson, and it was from, it's called Edge of Darkness, about the shenanigans of big corporations in the atomic energy field. And in it, he's an ex-cop or a retired cop, and his daughter belongs to a radical group. It's an interesting story. In the time of the Gaia idea, you know, by Lovelock, the planet will turn on people, and the friends of the Earth and all these groups are going to be warriors. You see, kind of Marxist warriors to save the world by eliminating a good chunk of the population. That's how else you going to do it? Eh? So man again was the enemy, Club of Rome. So in the Mel Gibson one, it was naturally shortened into an hour and a half or whatever. But the series they did in Britain years before, back in the 80s, was, I think, a six-part series. And well done. And it brings into the actual play or the movie a few different agencies, intelligence agents, who all know each other, the stratas and their names and so on, of their actual agencies, including the interaction between US agents and CIA and etc. to do with atomic energy field. And you'll see how each agency is working with other agencies and sharing data and files and secret files on everybody and everything. But you also see them trying to pull little moves on other agencies to get more from a different country, the other countries involved, like America, and vice versa. You see all, and you also see them sacrificing sometimes their own operatives in the field. They sacrifice them when you want rid of them. They know a little too much sometimes. If you're set on a certain job, you start to figure out what's really going on above what you've been told, and so they sacrifice them. But without a problem. And you see the psychopathic nature of the characters at the very end, how they discuss people in general and people who've been used and wiped out to attain goals that some of them, who are now wiped out or died out of radiation or whatever, had no idea that they were getting used for these purposes. This is perfect manipulation and field management of radical groups, even into the radicalization of groups. And I think the plot eventually was that the cop's daughter and with a group had gone in to try to find a hot cell in an era where Britain was taking in recycled fissionable material. And they have a way of actually recycling the stuff and making it all potent, full strength again, and selling it off during Maggie Thatcher's time. So they get in there. They don't know that they've been set up to go in the first place, and that the old miner that helps to bring them in to help to get down to this underground base, you see, where the real work was done on the basically the cells, these radioactive cells, isotopes. The guy who led them in was like a labor union leader, working class type, but they don't know till halfway through or towards the end that he was a member also of the secret. He'd been inducted into the British system to protect the atomic energy system. And it led these characters, and they got flushed out eventually with radioactive water. Most of them died. And but it was so amazing. Towards the end, you find out, I hate to even mention it in case anybody wants to see it, but the father, who was through all this detective work to find out what was happening, he was so naive in that area, etc., and to find out that his daughter had been set up to be killed and all the rest of it with the group that she worked with, rather than have it exposed, then he gets involved with a ex-CIA guy who's gone a bit rogue. And the CIA guy comes out with some plutonium in a case at the end of it. I won't tell you the rest of it there, but it isn't until later on that you find out that the different groups, organisations, including the higher levels of the CIA, wanted them to do that. They used them to do it, to get the plutonium out, because it was going to get banned to an extent, but they wanted the plutonium. They couldn't do it because of their legal restrictions, etc. So they used a group to go in, thinking they were going to agitate and steal it and expose it to the public, what was going on. But no, everybody gets used, and folk never figure this out in real intelligence work. They never figure it out. Remember a few years ago, in fact, I think one of the fellow came out and gave a lot of good information at the time. I think he came out with his partner and MI5, I think he was in. Although he did some international work as well, which is MI6. But he gave some good talks on things that were wrong at the time. He had been reprimanded and so on. Sometimes that's used as a tactic to get people to believe they are or they have gone rogue and they've had a slap on the wrist or getting punished, and then they try and recruit them too. That's very common as well, you know. So you have to always be wary of these kind of things. But he gave a lot of good information out. But his job for years had been to infiltrate the left-wing groups and then to manipulate them to do things like what's been talking about in the movie version. That's what they do. So in The Edge of Darkness, the British version, they show you some of the techniques that are used. It's quite interesting to watch, including the old computer system they used to use, which is there too, in London. For anybody who was under total surveillance went through that one computer for years ago. I'm sure it's all changed these days. Now, the folk have no idea. They're getting used, monitored, and spied upon, and manipulated. And it's done so professionally by experts who are trained in this way that they'll never fathom it out. So they've all been used to the bitter end, even when it happens. They just can't fathom it. That's quite some, isn't it? That's perfect manipulation and understanding, as you say, of the dark arts, as they like to call it. And there's no one you could trust. You would never know who was genuine. You know. That's generally how it is. So there's always a double, triple, quadruple game going on, and even higher levels of that to get things done eventually, and by using people like pawns who never figure out they're being used. That's good intelligence work, as they call it, you see. And I'm sure if you were looked into, as I said before, when I put the articles up where it had the financing for Black Lives Matter, millions and millions of dollars coming in from the top corporations, for goodness sake, even after the leaders of the BLM movement came out and admitted publicly that they're trained Marxist organizers. Well, again, trained to overthrow the existing system, eh? And trained using all other kinds of groups, anything to create splits and divisions, including their gender identity, anything they can use, they use it. It's nothing to do with what they tell you. They say the argument is irrelevant. It's all about the revolution, stupid, you see. Everyone's fighting each other over points of this or points of that or morality. No, this is all division to create chaos. Rather than have folk unified for one cause. That's how it's done. Standard stuff. But he's the top wealthiest corporations. All of them. Including all the ones presently that you're allowed to get your food from. Everything else has been closed. That's just coincidence, of course. And throwing money at them. And it goes eventually too, as well, to the Antifa groups. Which are really, and a lot of them really think that they're having a communist revolution at the bottom level. Standard stuff. And the ones in the lead, amongst the ones who are the radical the ones who want to go killing people, because there are lots of them out there. These are the ones on the fringes, you see.